We would like to welcome everybody tonight to Karen's teleseminar. I'm your host, Melinda Gerrish, and I'm from Shirley, Indiana. And my husband and I have a horse motel called Cutting Up Stables. So anyway, Karen, would you like to go ahead and get started this evening?
Yeah, that's great.
Okay, so we had several questions in, and first I wanted to, before we get into the questions, we really want to thank you for doing the camp last month out in Missouri. We really had a lot of fun, and I know there's several of them listening in tonight, and it was just a lot of fun to get to meet those people and spend a full week. The camps have really, you've always talked how great they are, and it really is a lot of fun to get to spend that much time with your horse and the other people and share in that experience. So,
yeah, well, and I want to thank you, Melinda, for, you know, helping set that up and finding such a wonderful place. Chuck and Kay, meeting them was such a special treat. I'm just amazed at that facility and what those people do. I've been reading Chuck's book on living the American dream, and what an inspiration.
And that's
Oh, they're just really amazing people, and it always reminds me yet again to, you know, surround yourself with the type of people that are going to help you aspire to your goals rather than, you know, kind of drag you down. We're not always aware what environment we place ourselves in. So it's I have a heightened sensitivity to that, and it was just such a wonderful experience to have all of you there, and Chuck and Kay were just wonderful hosts. But, I had a great time, too.
Okay. And, you know, once you get back, then you realize what you really did bring back home with you. You know, there's so many things that you're going through and thinking about it. And one thing you're really good at doing is, you know, observing and giving pieces, you know, that they need right at the right time. And you really helped me through a part just working with Latigo on the, you know, the come to and you know, having that fear at that point. And you say, no, he's in a different place now. And just listening to you say that and meaning it. I know you wouldn't give that opinion unless, and it took that moment to change where we were, you know, it kind of where we got stuck there and that fear, you've been able to break through that, and I appreciate that. So,
That's great. I'm glad to hear that.
Well, let's go ahead and get started here tonight. So, the first one is on learned behavior versus fear. And it says, my question relates to learned behavior, the kind maybe we don't want in our horses, specifically at the camp, is it Verde? Is that how that would be, the clinic that you did?
Verde.
Verde,
mm-hmm.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
You identified two of these behaviors in my horse, the wonderful gray horse. One was the behavior he had where he got very close to me and was touching me with his muzzle, the hug, and the other was when you moved him up to the fence during a demonstration and he started snorting. Right away, you said something to the effect that your hunch was that this snorting was a learned behavior. This fascinated me because this is one of his signature behaviors. That has always caused me concern. And he starts snorting, I get unconfident because I think he's about to spook. He snorts often at things. I assume I have inadvertently taught him this because I take away pressure when he snorts. I'm not aware of it specifically, but I might be. I'm trying to pay attention to this now. So my question is, why did you suspect learning behavior more specifically for his snorting? What made you realize that it may be learned behavior instead of thinking that he was just snorting out of fear of objects hanging on his fence? The hugging behavior I understand better, as it is not such a normal thing for a horse to do, but the snorting is kind of a normal horse thing. How can I learn to identify learned behavior as opposed to unlearned reactions? And then the second part of that question is, what should I do when he starts the snorting behavior? For example, when I'm leading him by something and he gets to snorting. It often happens at home when I lead him up to the hitching rail, almost always when anything is different. I enjoyed the clinic with you. You're a wonderful teacher. Thanks for the opportunity, Brenda.
Well, I have to really commend Linda because Linda got to that clinic against all odds. She had trailer wiring problems. She couldn't get there on the Friday. She told me at the end of the clinic, she said when she finally got in there at midnight, you know, she missed the first day of the clinic. She had, you know, she was on it. She said, I debated on just going, forget it. I'm going home. She came all the way from southern Arizona, you know, quite a ways away. And she said that she was putting her horse up that night and feeding, and she was tired and frustrated and everything. She said, boy, this woman better be good. I have to tell you, Linda, that cracked me up, because you know what? When you put that kind of effort into getting to a place to get the kind of help that you need, you do have that expectation. You have every right to have that expectation. And she said she was just delighted at those kinds of things. But those kinds of things that Linda's describing right there are patterns that I see, you know, regularly. It's not, you know, every day, but I've seen it so often that I recognize those behaviors as patterns. And I give examples, you know, horses are so intelligent that they can demonstrate a behavior, and if we back off the pressure, you'll see more of that behavior. I mean, that's how you would teach a horse to nod his head yes or no. That'd be how you teach a horse any kind of a trick. It's how you teach a horse to pick up do a flying lead change, because you apply pressure and release into the new lead. So it's the same principle of taking the comfort away and then giving it back. You know, and you take the comfort away in a certain pattern so that the horse knows where their comfort is going to be. So you're either in the teaching, reinforcing, or refining stage. So I've seen horses enough to have these patterns of behavior. And I'm sorry, Linda, but I have to talk about the hugging behavior, because it was really amazing to me when I took Linda's horse for the first time and I observed that he was walking in her space and these kinds of things. And I asked the class to just observe the horse's behavior and just tell me what you see. And it was really amazing. This horse came around with his nose in his neck, and he just curled around me and held his head, his cheek, against my arm, just along the side. Not really or anything. He just held me right there. And I looked over at Linda and said, he hugs you, doesn't he? And she goes, he does. I love it. It's so nice. And it is, you know, until that's not what you're asking him to do. And what was really amazing when Linda created a new pattern of having the horse stand at a distance away from her, like out beyond her ability to touch him, he was standing there, and it was really amazing. We all watched as he curled his head around in that same position, and she said, Karen, what's he doing? And I said, he's hugging you, but you're not there. And that really clicked. See, that really clicked, that we inadvertently reinforce, you know, any kind of behavior. So when I saw the horse snorting as we were coming up to the rail, to me, if the horse views me in the lead position and I'm up at the rail and the horse comes up snorting, then he's not viewing me in the lead position. The lead horse would not go, oh my gosh, what are you snorting at? That lead horse just says, come on, we're going up to the rail. And I say it's okay. And so if I say it's okay, then you can trust me that it's okay. What we don't realize that we do, because we're afraid, see, and here's the key phrase in that question there, we're afraid that the horse is going to spook. When a horse spooks, it's big, it's powerful, it's unpredictable, okay? And we don't necessarily have the muscle memory to respond appropriately to that behavior. So what we tend to do when the horse snorts or looks like they're going to spook, we tend to back off, again, inadvertently reinforcing the behavior. So when I saw the horse snorting, I went, wow, that's interesting. There's no reason for him to snort. Come up. He's looking at this, looking at that. I've seen horses get a pattern that I call the looky-loos. The horse, all of a sudden, you know, it looks in like that movie Up, where the dogs go, squirrel, and all the dogs freeze and look, you know, stare blindly, you know, blankly out. You know, they just freeze and look for the squirrel. And it's almost like the horse goes, squirrel, you know, and looks out into the distance. And I've had horses in my hands where I'm going along, all of a sudden the horse, you know, looks up and looks out, and there's, you know, nothing there. Now, sometimes there is something there. Deb did that tonight when I was taking him back to the pasture. He looked, and I looked up over the top of the fence, and the buffalo were kind of milling around on the other side of this wooden fence. And I said, fair enough, now let's go. Okay. If I had stopped and said, soothed him and said, oh, darling, you need to get okay with this, I could have inadvertently reinforced that behavior. So how I recognize it is that I've seen it so consistently so many, many times that a lot of times people will look at me and go, you know, how do you see that so fast? And I look at him and say, it's like I'm a mind reader, huh? And I go, how do you know that I do that? And he does that because the horse basically is, it has no filters. The horse is real behavior, real time, real in the moment. But you will see patterns of behavior that will reflect our behavior. Okay, so if I give my horse to somebody who's extremely knowledgeable and those kinds of things, if I had Jack Brainerd ride my horse and he's picking up my horse and asking for flying lead changes, he would feel my current ability at flying lead changes in an instant because he's ridden millions of flying lead changes. He's the master at flying lead changes. So, you know, I do flying lead changes, but not to Jack, you know, Mr. Brainerd's level, if that makes sense. So I'm in that stage as well in different areas, but we're always aspiring to putting ourselves under the auspicion of somebody more knowledgeable, more experienced, so that they can give us that feedback from their own experience instead of us having to figure it out on our own. And that's what, you know, in the face of all adversity, got Linda to keep driving, keep going, and get to the clinic, even though, you know, everything was against you. You knew that there was something, you know, waiting for you there. And people will say, well, why do you go to clinics? Why do you go to learning rooms? And I tell people, you know what? I have to show up to find out. But it's just like you said, Melinda, you know, I didn't know until we got to that spot where you were at with Latigo, until I saw it, and then we could explore it, and then I could recognize it, and then I could share with you, you know, from those experiences. And that's what the learning experience is really all about. So how did I recognize it? To me, when the horse is snorting, they're not recognizing me in a position of leadership, and all the hugging in the world does not earn that position. It tells the horse not to be afraid of you, but it doesn't necessarily give that horse that recognition of your position in the herd hierarchy when they're going into a different place or something's new or something's different. So all those pieces, from the hugging to the snorting at the rail, they all tie together. And I think that's what Linda found, you know, over the course of the time that she did have in the clinic. Because when she left, it just looked like a different picture than when she arrived. So I really want to commend her for making the effort to be there and to experience that and have the curiosity to continue to consider what was said at the clinic and explore it and ask more questions about it.
Okay. All right. Well, we thank you, Brenda, for submitting that question, and we hope that helps. And so it's real interesting there. So, and, you know, Karen, you're talking about different things at the camp that happened. And I tell you, that clover leaf pattern, it is wonderful with that forward motion with Latigo too. I don't remember if you have that on your videos at all, describing how that worked, but it has really helped him get that forward motion and then come into the middle. And I mean, we almost got a sliding stop going on. This is just really, really a good
Well, I warn you, hang on. When the horse gets that pattern, they will sit down and put some 11s in the ground.
Yeah.
Because you're finding their desire. You're finding desire. Yeah. That's great.
So is that one of the things, is it in a video I've not realized yet and need to go back and I'll pick it up again, or do you need to incorporate that into something?
Yeah, that's in my advancing series. That
okay.
is... in progress. That's this year's project to capture, you know,
okay.
all of those things. Because really the foundation series that's out there is the very start. I mean, it is the foundation. Now, if the foundation isn't there, and my foundation series is a little bit different. I've had a lot of people say, oh, I thought it was just going to be more of the same stuff. It's explained very differently. And even I'm recognizing how differently it is, you know, today. But the next stage, the foundation, and there's advancing, and then there's, you know, the finish. And so those stages are going to be captured here. That's part of my project
okay.
list this year.
Okay. Well, we definitely want everyone to look forward to seeing that advancing video. And if you are having that forward motion, you need to be finding out about this clover leaf deal and stuff, because it really works. And he's
so good.
Yeah, amazing progress there. So. Okay, well, we will move on here. This one is a question from Mary, and it's in regards to the red light use. And she says she recently purchased a red light, and she, after she's discussed using it in any of I said, we wanted to know if she'd ever discussed it in any of the teleseminars and asked if we could discuss that a little bit. She said she's just learning how and when to use it and would appreciate any guidance or reasonable expectation. And she said, to be honest, she was going to send it back after a couple of weeks because it wasn't helping her sore shoulders. And now she's thinking that maybe perhaps she's not using it often enough, or maybe she's not using it in the right ways and wants to know a little bit more about, do you use it on the acupuncture points, or do you use it directly with where it's hurting? So I'm just wondering if you could kind of describe a little bit of your uses on that.
Sure. And, you know, I'm not saying that the red light, you know, can fix everything under the sun. I just haven't known of anybody that it has not made a noticeable improvement or a complete, remedy of every kind of thing, you know, you can imagine. But if listeners aren't familiar with red light therapy, it's non-invasive, self-administering acupuncture, but without needles. In fact, Photonic Health, who manufactures the light, prefers that I say acupressure, but it's basically acupuncture, acupressure points, they're the same. So maybe you call them acu-light points, I don't know. But basically, this particular wavelength of light has a property that penetrates into collagen tissue about an inch and a half. So the wavelength of light replaces the pressure or the needles in acupuncture, but they are the same nerve bundles. So in answer to the question, are there certain points? Yes, there are certain points that you use. Like a point for a shoulder, there might be a point that you would use the light on your leg or your foot or your hand for a shoulder. So the neural pathways, basically the light or the needles or the pressure isn't what cures you. It's the stimulation of the acupuncture point, which is a nerve bundle, which opens up the neural pathways so that the brain can recognize an area that needs healing and continue to address the injury, whether it's chronic or recent, until it's taken care of. So in a short explanation, I had a bad knee for about 11 years. And if I sat with my knee bent for longer than 20, 30 minutes, it would become aching to a point of throbbing, to a point of tears coming out of my eyes. If I was stuck on an airplane or something like that with turbulence and I couldn't get up or straighten my leg, it would really hurt me. And when I started using this light, I was just hoping for maybe, 20% reduction in discomfort, even half, I'd be thrilled. It took about 6 weeks of using the light on that knee, and since I did that, that knee feels like my other knee. I mean, exactly the same. And that's what really proved the effectiveness of that light. And the original inventor of it, Dr. McLaren, who's a retired veterinarian, he's gone, moved back and retired to Australia, but he explained it to me. He said, basically, your body, when I had that knee injury, it was a sports injury, he said, your body heals for about 2 weeks, then it starts laying down scar tissue, it starts desensitizing, shutting down the neural pathway. All the light does is the same thing as a needle, and he is an acupuncturist with needles. He studied in China for many years. He holds the highest rating. He trains acupuncturists. That's how experienced he is. But being a veterinarian, he came across horses that would not tolerate the needle, and that's really where this light began to be developed. So he had the same result with the light as he did with the needles, and then found that people would treat themselves longer to a point of complete healing rather than coming in, getting some results with the acupuncture, and then the time and the money for each treatment. People just wouldn't continue for the longevity that the treatment needed to be to get the ultimate result. So that's the simple explanation of it. I was not familiar with acupuncture or anything when I started to use it, but I kept using it to prove that it wouldn't work, and it kept proving me wrong. So, and I'll take back the light at any time. If you use it for 6 months and it doesn't do a thing for you, send it back to me. To this date, I've only had one come back. I've carried this light for years and years. I've used it personally for, it's got to be about 10 years now. And I've used it on everything from, a child bedwetting problem to horse colicking. It works fantastic on colic. It doesn't replace the call to the veterinarian, but I've had horses passing manure before the vet even gets there. Somebody I mean, I could go on and on and on about it. But when my knee felt as good as my other knee, I just went, okay, this really has something to it. Now, acupuncture is an ancient healing modality. So it's not like it's something newfangled or something like that. It's just this light has a depth of penetration and effectiveness on that neural pathway. So that's why I encourage people, if you're skeptical, like I was, you know, when I first came across it, I went, oh, this is ridiculous, but what the heck, prove it to yourself. But look in the book. There's books that come with it. Find the point specifically for the shoulder, but also just put it where it hurts. You know, if I have something where I get bruised or something like that, I put it where the bruise is. You know, I drop the, silly wheelbarrow. You know, I dump the wheelbarrow full of manure and it's, kind of swung back and, hit the top of my foot. And I just ran over, grabbed a red light. Now, here's the two hardest things about when to use a red light. Number one is to think about using it. And I don't know why this is. I've caught myself doing it myself. I'll think, oh, I'm getting a headache, and you don't think about using the red light. You go get an aspirin or you go along and think, oh, here we go, and it's funny because you have to remind people. It's like, well, did you try the red light? And my husband does that for me. He's like, well, did you use the red light? But it's using it, and then also it's giving it the credit, use the red light on the temples or the back of the neck, at the base of the neck, and then you realize later, oh, I didn't get a headache, and your brain or my brain tends to rationalize and say, well, I wasn't really going to get a headache anyway. And that's where it's really hard, to recognize the results of it. Now, Melinda, you have an amazing example of the red light where you had complete separation of your elbow. Mm-hmm. And what was it, within 10 days, 2 weeks?
Well, they told me it'd be 10 months to a year before I had use of my arm, if I would get use of it. And in 8 weeks, it was way better. And, I mean, I had full extension, full flexion, and about 8 or 9 doctors in there wanting to see what went on. It was a huge, huge deal. Not only to myself, but they didn't understand it, and they wanted more information on the light because they knew something different had happened with the way that my elbow healed. So it's real big. Something I'll mention, and it took me a little while to realize this, and so I try to mention it to others that use the light. In the book, not only does it show the sequence or, the points of the acupuncture, but there's an actual sequence that you have to go follow through, the number sequence, in that order, or you're not getting it efficiently used either. So, and I missed that at the very beginning and was just putting it, where I wanted, even though the points were there. But you really need to start with the numbers of flow and go through that, and it does make a difference. So,
right. And you want to make sure you touch the light to the skin. You don't push into it because it changes the density of the collagen. It doesn't have the depth of penetration if you push. Mm-hmm. So you want to just touch the skin.
And you don't need to rub it.
No, yeah, not rub it.
I've
just hold it.
Rub, just hold.
Yeah, and I've seen people kind of wave it over the area. You want to, like a wand or something, it's like you want to touch the skin. Actually, make contact without putting pressure. Hold it there 5 to 10 to 15 seconds, depending on what you're doing, and then, move it about 1.5 inches to another area. So if I'm working on an area that's bruised, or if I have a sore neck or something like that, my lower back, I actually had my right hip was kind of giving me fits, just getting a little catch in it sometimes. And it was funny because in my brain I kind of went, oh my bad hip, and finally I went, what is the matter with me? And I got the red light out and probably used it, I'll bet it was probably about a week, just while you're just relaxing in the evening, just wherever. I didn't look at the hip points or anything. I'm probably bad about that. And then one day I just kind of went along and went, oh, my hip doesn't bother me. Then I quit using it, and it started catching again. So I was like, oh, maybe I have to use it longer than a few days. So believe me, I am the worst at, following any kind of regime or anything like that. But today my hip doesn't bother me at all. And I'm, like I said, I'm not saying that it it fixes everything. I've just had so many experiences. My mom, when she was alive, she tripped over the dog, broke her arm, and she was, you know, in her 70s, late 70s, and, you know, she had a cast on her arm and her hands throbbing in this silly cast, and she's, oh, you know, and I said, well, Mom, use a red light. She holds this cast up. She goes, it's in a cast. And of course, there's only mothers and daughters can talk to each other. I said, well, put it where you can reach it. And she took the light, put it all over her hand and above the cast on her arm. And we were sitting there, you know, visiting. And finally said, hey, Mom, how's your arm? She says, oh, it's fine. I said, well, Mom, wasn't it throbbing a little bit ago? She goes, yeah, it was. So, I mean, it's silly things like that. And even the doctor was like, you, Melinda, when, you know, he took the cast off and said, didn't you just break this, you know, 3 weeks ago? I mean, it was only like three or some weeks. She said, yeah. And he said, you're mended. I mean, it's when the doctors or even the veterinarians, you know, will say, no, that can't be right. And it's like, well, it is right. So, again, it doesn't do the healing. It just gives the body the optimal, you know, neural pathways. The body has to have proper nutrition, movement, opening of neural pathways, you know, but the electrical system makes everything work. So you can have great nutrition or exercise and things like that, but if you have resistance in the electrical system, the body is not getting the information, the signals at a cellular level back and forth at the optimum. And that's the easiest way that I can explain it. But I keep using it. Like I said, that the knee issue for me took 6 weeks. There was a woman that had a shoulder issue, you know, a sharp pain, like an ice pick in her shoulder. And I did one treatment following the points for the shoulder in the book, one treatment. And we went in the ladies' room at the facility we were at the time because some of the points I couldn't get to with the dark-colored shirt that she had on. It needs to be either touching the skin or going through a thin or light-colored shirt. And you can put the light up to the fabric to see how much of the light is being blocked out by the fabric. That may be another factor, too. But she literally went in. She's in her brassiere. I finished the points, and she puts her arm up over her head, and her eyes get really big, and she goes, oh, my gosh. I mean, it was like, you know, a miracle. She's jumping around. She starts almost running out of the bathroom, the ladies' room, without her shirt on, going, I can't believe it. And, you know, I saw her talked to her on the phone, it was probably 3 or 4 years later, and she recognized, she asked my name, and I told her, and she said, Karen, it's me, Gail. And she said, you know, she told me she was that woman. She said, do you know that pain has never come back? And, you know, so I've seen situations like that, too, and it's really hard to tell, you know, what the experience is going to be. But if it's only been a couple of weeks, I would hang in there. I would keep using it. You can use it up to 4 times a day on a recent injury. But give yourself a break, like probably every 4 or 5 days. Don't do the treatment because the body will actually desensitize if you do too much. But you can't hurt anything if you do it too much. You just give yourself a break and then start up again. So, like I said, it was about 6 weeks for that knee injury, and I've known other people. Dan Moyer, my cowboy friend, he uses it on his shoulder, and he's also broken his back. He uses it on his back quite a bit because he still has a very physical job. You know, all kinds of things. I could go on and on, but I'd hang in there with it. If it still doesn't work for you, you know, please send it back to me. I don't want anybody to have any of my products or videos or education or, you know, even attend a clinic that you're not happy with. You know, I want to make it fair to you because it, you know, these things work for me and work for other people. I wouldn't carry it or offer it if it didn't. I'm just not that way. I could get sponsorships by big corporations, but I don't use their products. So, you know, if it's something that I carry or offer, it's something that I use and believe in and have experienced the results myself personally. So.
Okay. Yeah. All right. Well, good luck there. So I think just stick with it, and hopefully she'll find out that it works as well as it has for me. So.
Mm.
Okay. All right. We'll go ahead and move on to another question here, Karen. This one's from Donna. And this one's basically getting her started here. It says, hi, Karen, I do not know how to ride. I bought an Arabian gelding for my daughter a couple years ago. She took a few falls and now is too scared to ride and really isn't interested anymore. I am in love with the horse and would like to have more of a relationship with him and would like to enrich his life. I would love to be able to take him on trails, and he is very social and has lots of energy and interest in life. He is only 6, but he hasn't been ridden in 2 years. What do you think? I checked your schedule, and you do not seem to have a clinic planned in Colorado for 2011. Might that change? What kind of clinic do you recommend I start with? Thanks, Donna.
Well, when a horse hasn't been ridden for longer, you know, it depends on the experience of the horse. If it's a very, very experienced horse and it's been, you know, set out in pasture for a while, you know, not so much. But a horse that, for kind of all the conditions that you're describing, you know, that the horse has high energy, he has a lot of interest, your daughter's fallen off, come off him a few times, so that indicates to me that, you know, he's not as experienced as a, you know, old broke ranch horse, you know, and then your experience level. The ideal thing, if you're in a learning stage, is to learn on a less challenging, more experienced horse first. That's ideal. Okay. So, and the reason I say this is because I used to have a differing opinion, because I do know what it's like to be attached to a horse that isn't necessarily the ideal horse for the current stage of ability that I'm in. Believe me, I have had, I want to say, all the wrong horses, because I love those horses. There's an emotional connection that I have with each and every one of them. But in hindsight, I would have gained more skills faster if my teaching partner would have been experienced enough to help build my confidence, my skill and ability, rather than it's like two people learning at the same time. It's like people say, oh, I'm going to buy a young horse for my child so they can grow up together. Well, there's a fun little saying that says green, you know, a horse that's green, you know, green on green makes black on blue. And what you don't want to do is have the experience like your daughter did, which is to put yourself and the horse beyond both of your current skill level and get yourself in trouble or hurt. I mean, to me, that is the most important thing. And if you look at things objectively rather than with our heart, and you say, okay, you want to develop this skill and ability and have that horse and you riding off happily in the sunset. In my opinion, the way you would go about that is that you would start learning with a more experienced horse and then have that horse go to somebody, and I can recommend several people in Colorado that will, you know, take a horse and you'll get a wonderful result, okay? Don't take your horse to just anybody. I can't tell you how many stories that people say, gosh, this horse had so much trust in me and people and all this thing, and it went to somebody, you know, and now the horse comes back and you can't even touch him, you know, or pet him or anything. So it's not just go have anybody go, you know, put miles on him. That's not it. So what I would do is, you know, start learning with a more experienced horse. In fact, I came across a website last night where some working ranch cowboys got together, and they have a sale. I don't know that it's every year, but the sale is in Queen Creek, Arizona, next weekend on the 20th, and I think I'm going to make the trip down there to go see this, because it looks very interesting to me. They're ranch horses. They're used 3 to 5 years on ranches. They have doctored cattle. They have open gates. They have packed animals. They have packed. They've, you know, carried hunters, they've packed out elk. You know, these horses have seen every situation and every scenario. It'd probably be hard to find something that these horses would have trouble with. They've just been there, done that, bought the t-shirt. And I looked at that and I watched all the videos of all the cowboys riding them, and they are handy. They're a handy group of men that are using these horses on real working ranches. So for years, not just, oh, well, you know, we have 30 days on them. So if that gives you the picture, now I look at that and say, wow, where are you going to go to a sale where they have, you know, I don't think they'll have a lot there at the sale, probably 15 to 20, which is nothing like big sales, that they'll have, you know, 30 to 70 to 170, you know, horses come through a sale. They have a very select group of horses that they feel, and they're very honest about it. You know, there's one horse in there that I really liked, and they said, you know, he has trouble around his back legs. You know, they're very honest about it. It's not like, oh, you're going to find out something, you know, later. So that's my recommendation is to find a horse. People will say, well, you know, I can't afford that. And, you know, of course, you have to consider all those things. But you really can't afford a hospital visit either, you know. And worse yet, you know, worse yet is to have an accident that makes you lose interest like your daughter did. You know, to me, that would be the greater tragedy, to have, you know, something that you love and you enjoy have something happen, then all of a sudden there's this big fear barrier sitting in front of you that you'll spend the rest of your life moving through. And I can't tell you how common a scenario that is that people go along and they think, well, I love him, so therefore he loves me, and, you know, it looks like the Black Stallion movie. Well, I'm sorry, but that is not the reality. You know, sometimes it is. People will say, oh, I got a Mustang, and we ride off happily in the sunset. And that's the one in a thousand. You know, but that seems to be the story that everybody, you know, is attracted to and feels like that's, you know, that could be me. Well, it could be, but maybe not. And to me, the risk is too high. So I'm just explaining it to you as honestly as I can, because I've told people if they will follow my recommendation that they will go along and experience, you know, success if they will follow my recommendation. But to take a horse that has, you know, less experience than another horse, and the person that has very little skill and ability, which is the first thing you said, I do not know how to ride. Okay, that's good to know, because some people don't even know that about themselves. So you're ahead of the game. I want to give you a thumbs up on that one, because, you know, riding to me is the mere act of not falling off. And, you know, keeping a leg on each side and going in the same speed. But to be able to hold communication, hold a conversation with a horse when that horse is questioning the situation or leaving the situation. And I'll give you a scenario. Last night, I'm riding my two well-trained Andalusian horses, Berg and Deb, and I said, you know what, we're just going to go out. It was kind of dusk, and I said, we're going to go out around the neighborhood. I don't ride around a lot of neighborhoods, and I'm in a place where I can go a little ride around the neighborhood. Well, barking dogs don't bother them. You know, dogs running through the bushes, barking on the other side of the fence. It doesn't bother them, none of that. But here came two dogs around the front. Now, I have been in this neighborhood, and I know those two dogs, and they bark pretty hard. There's dogs across the street that bark pretty hard, you know, from them, too. Two cars happened to be coming down at the same time. Those dogs were coming out looking at the cars. I know they hadn't seen the horses yet. And about that time, the dogs see the horses. The cars are coming by me. Here come the dogs. And that wasn't a problem until the second dog turns and comes towards us, and it had a cone around his head. He'd had some kind of procedure on his front paw. And here came this black chow with this cone around its head at dusk, and it looked like a giant eyeball floating off the ground coming right towards us. And I'll tell you what, both Berg and Deb were like, what the heck is that thing? They both, you know, backed up, and I knew that I had the muscle memory to keep them straight. But here they were backing up just as fast as they could. Cars were coming by me on this little driveway, and with all my skill and ability and all these things, I've shot guns off these horses. You know, I've done everything I can imagine. I've driven them, I've pulled across, you know, everything, the big, pink, wiggly guy. But in that situation, I'll tell you what, with a lesser experience level or anything like that, it would have been a huge wreck, maybe even having horses run in front of vehicles. So, you know, that's the ultimate, you know, situation that you want to prepare yourself for. And those things can and do happen. And here I am, right before that happens. And actually, I talked to audiences. I said, you know, something's about to happen when you're looking around and everything seems like rainbows and butterflies. And I'm almost home at this point. I'm almost back to the ranch. So, you know, that's the reality of horses, is, you know, being the most prepared that you can be for any given situation. And to have that horse have such a strong connection to you that even though they're watching a floating eyeball in the dark come at him, and with cars going by, that they're still following my feel. in my direction in that situation. So to me, the best advice I could give you is to, you know, start riding on a more confident horse. The other horse, the Arabian, what I do is I'd get the DVD series, and I would start studying my DVD series, get the tools for communication, and really immerse yourself in that study and start developing your skills and abilities first on the ground. The ground skills are called riding from the ground. And this is something people have a big mental miss on. They just miss the concept of riding from the ground. To last night, when the floating eyeball came at us, my hands were automatically in a position and in the right kind of place to help my horse be in the position, in the safest position he could be in under those circumstances. Then it was automatic. I didn't have time to go, oh, I wonder what I should do here. It just comes out of you. That starts when you're just doing simple tasks on the ground. So riding from the ground is developing your ability to hold a conversation with your hands. Then you move into riding from above, and that's where you're sitting astride a 1,200-pound prey animal that wants to go with the other animals, and developing your seat and your legs to enhance that communication. So it's piecing those things together and developing that ability within yourself to first to then be able to offer that to a horse. Now, the more experienced horse in the learning stage is going to be much more forgiving because that horse says, oh, yeah, she's not very good yet, but she's trying, okay? The less experienced horse is saying, you know what? I have no idea what you're talking about. I can't even guess what it is that you want me to do. And then that's when the confusion can get you into trouble. So that's the recommendation that I would take with it is if that's what you want to do and learn about horses and be safe with horses, start on a more experienced horse first. And you don't even necessarily have to buy this horse. You can lease a horse. There's lots of people that have horses. The way the market is today, you can lease a horse that's very experienced and start developing your skills and abilities. I still wouldn't just jump straight into riding even with that horse. I'd take those videos and take that horse through all those tasks and techniques and develop your feel and get your timing, you know, practice with that horse first before you go to the less experienced horse and think, okay, do I want to have something to offer the less experienced horse so he's less confused. So if that gives you, it's kind of a big answer for, you know, what really is a big question. And please don't wait for a hands-on clinic to come to Colorado to start. Don't wait for that. I know this next year I have very few things on my schedule because I have other projects that I'm focusing on coming up this next year. Please don't go, oh, well, I guess I'm just on my own. You know, you're not. The videos that are on my website, there's video snippets, there's tons of information and education on my website. These teleseminars, the television show is free on Dish Network. You know, please get the information that you need. Don't just go out there or, you know, worse yet, just have, you know, somebody down the road go, oh, we can fix him, you'll be good. Okay, don't put yourself in that situation of risk. I really love to hear people's stories like Linda, you know, on the phone or on the teleseminar earlier, you know, that there were some concepts where she was stuck. But, you know, that could have come off the video as well. So, you know, please go on my website. The resources are there for you, but I can't do it for you. You know, even at the clinic, I can't do it for you. But a lot of times at the clinics, I'm explaining things that people could have known about months ago, years ago, you know, because it's on the video. To me today, I'm frustrated because when education is only a video away, we're sitting there and are with confusion. You know, our horses are confused about what it is that we're asking them to do. And to me today, there's just no excuse for it anymore. You know, it used to be before videos and, you know, back in the olden days when this information wasn't there, you'd have to travel or you'd have to go somewhere. You'd have to hang on the fence of the horseman, you know, down the road for years and years to find, you know, to kind of get something going there. It's not that way anymore. So don't hinder yourself just by our own limitations of what we think we can and can't do. When there's a desire, there is a way. So, you know, I put the map out there, but you got to take the first step.
Okay. All right. Well, thanks for submitting that question. And Karen, we'll go ahead and move on here to the next question. This one kind of comes back and is a follow-up from last month. And this was in regards to the one that was having trouble eating. Her horse was eating grass while she was trying to ride, if you recall. And she says, first, thanks for including that question in our program. And she says, P.S., we let him eat last night, all of his dinner, and he acted pretty much the same way. I took all the fight out of the exercise, letting him go forward quietly, which made it easier to stop him from going around me, and moved him quietly back to the right side, the one he left from. He did it a few more times, and I responded the same way. Each time he did less and less and relaxed more and more. I could feel him thinking about it the rest of the walk, but he would choose not to. I started rubbing him all over as we walked, but still checked him constantly if he tried to eat grass. I'm thinking that I pushed too hard to get him leading in different zones. He reacted negatively, and we recreated a habit out of the whole thing. Is there a way to get something in the middle, both together, instead of me or him? How does one motivate without pushing?
Well, it sounds like leading this time.
Mm-hmm.
Because, yes. And it sounds like, you know, when you're describing it, it's that the horse is on one side and they put pressure on the hindquarters and the horse walks around to the other side and then she puts him back on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yeah.
So it sounds like the horse is kind of sweeping around and she moves him back over there. And there's a habit forming, and
mm-hmm.
there is. So when the horse is starting to eat grass and I start to put pressure on the hindquarters, and the horse starts to go forward, I need to be ready with my pressure to adjust to out in front of the nose to say, but don't go forward. Okay. Otherwise, the horse goes, okay, well, I eat grass, and then she puts pressure on my hip, and then I swing around, then I swing over here, and na-na-na-na-na. But I didn't ask you to go forward. I asked you to pick your nose up, period. Okay, that's where your comfort is. So anytime the horse is demonstrating a behavior that you didn't ask for, they need to run into pressure to help them understand where their comfort is. And kind of I'm going to jump to the end of the question. Is there any way to motivate without pushing? Well, if you find out what that is, let me know. Because they're the same thing. You know, how do I motivate a horse without applying pressure? And I'm assuming, you know, I'm kind of creating that, you know, similarity between pressure and pushing. But, you know, it's the same thing. It's just taking the comfort away in order to give it back with the behavior that you are looking for. So, for example, I'll take kind of a similar situation, same pattern of behavior, different situation, trailer loading. I've seen people, you know, stand at the trailer and have the horse offer to go into the trailer where the horse turns around and then you go, okay, we'll circle around to the right and then we're going to circle you around to the left back to the trailer. Okay, oh, okay, well, let's circle around to the right, circle around. Well, you can spend 2 days doing that. So when the horse doesn't want to go in the trailer, I back them up and I'll take horses with this pattern of behavior and they'll go, oh, well, wait a minute, I got to circle around 37 times before, you know, I'm like, no, we're not circling around 37 times. You're just going to back up and then into the pressure like a rubber band and release as you're coming forward. And so I take that forward motion away. It's just, to me, it's an unproductive pattern of behavior because a horse going forward is not enough discomfort for a horse to want to find the comfort, if that makes sense. So, you know, if a horse is allowed to just, actually we kind of joke about it at clinics, you know, the horse is wallering around, which means he's just walking around and you're kind of like, okay, now he's, you know, if a horse takes even a half step forward and I haven't asked for it, I ask them to take that back. So, you know, being specific or being particular, but not being critical, you know, raising your expectations and recognizing when the horse is making this decision that wasn't your decision. Now, sometimes I'll allow it. It's not this regimented, militant, you know, kind of an approach, depending on what my you know, my purpose or my goal is. I've taken really scared horses, and I think I gave you this example, you know, horses that are just, you know, on the muscle, they've been, you know, whatever the situation has been, and I feel the horse kind of, you know, being a little naughty, like, oh, I'm going to maybe, you know, take a little bite of grass, and I'll allow that, because I want that horse to know that he's, you know, he shouldn't be afraid of doing anything wrong. So, but the horse is just dragging you around like a Hoover, you know, that's the opposite kind of a thing. So I want to just put that little, you know, comment in there that it's not this always regimented kind of thing. But if you just take away the forward motion, put the pressure on the hip, when the horse starts to lift his head and come forward, adjust that pressure with the teaching stick or your hand or the rope, and or even just, you know, bump a little bit on the halter and say, hey, it doesn't mean go forwards and waller around and waller back over here. It just means pick your head up. That's where your comfort is, not pick your head up and go wallering around out here. So if that kind of gives you an idea, that's what it sounds like in the question. I may have it all wrong there. If I do, put more specific behavior in the scenario, and we'll talk about it next month. But hopefully that'll you know, give the help. And also, if the horse is just sitting there like, oh, I'm going to eat, oh, I'm going to eat, I'm going to eat, you have permission to bite them anyway, and it needs to be something that they don't want to feel again, and not maliciously, not meanly, not anything, just, you know, it's kind of like if you're cooking dinner and the kids are coming in hovering around the cookie jar, okay, if you just go, oh, don't, oh, okay, just one, you know, it needs to be a look as if, don't even think about it. You do not even want to experience these consequences, you see. So, you know, it's not being mean. It's not being aggressive. It's not anything. It's being clear in your communication and your expectation of behavior. So hopefully that'll help you a little bit with that scenario.
Okay. All right, Karen, we're going to try to squeeze this one last question in here if we can.
Okay.
This one's from Julie, and it says, my horse does not stand still to be saddled. She isn't afraid of the pad or anything. At least I don't think so. I can rub the saddle pad all over her, and it doesn't seem to bother her. This horse does everything I ask her to do, but she moves around while I'm trying to saddle her, and then my pad gets all messed up and not in the right spot when I go to lift the saddle on her.
And again, kind of taking different scenarios in there, pad doesn't seem to be what she has the association to. It seems to be a saddle. Unless, usually when people are using a Western saddle, that's pretty heavy, they'll tend to do just one big oomph, you know, and put it on there. What the horse needs, and I do this in colt starting or horses that don't like to be saddled, I'll take that saddle on and off, 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 and have the horse not tied when you do this. Have the halter and lead on, have the lead over your arm. But what I would recommend is I'd recommend watching the Safe Saddling DVD. It's part of the Dish Network television show, but there's two parts to that's Safe Saddling, and that's, you know, your granddaughter's favorite episode anyway.
It is.
but it'll show how to set up your rigging, how to set up even a heavy Western saddle in such a way that you would be more comfortable lifting it on and off multiple times. Now, if your particular saddle is too heavy to do that with on and off, you know, enough times for that horse to get comfortable and confident with it, you know, borrow a saddle or use something, not just the pad, you know, but that saddle. But there's a way to swing a saddle up on a horse that it doesn't come down on their back hard, you know, nothing falls off. There's a way to set up your rigging and swing it up there very, you know, nice and smooth. And that's what I do with colts. When I judged the colt string competition in Virginia, a couple of weeks ago, that's how I was watching. That was one of the things I was watching. I was watching for how the people approach those colts, you know, for their first saddling, because, you know, the first saddling is, you know, first impressions are lasting impressions. And boy, I judged very heavily on how the, you know, three different competitors, you know, approached that point in starting the colt. So, you know, putting a pad on a colt or a tarp on a colt or all those things, that's different than how you know, place a saddle. And then a lot of times people think, oh, I got to lift it up and place it lightly. And it's not the pressure. It's how you set it up there. It's how there's a way to swing it up there, you know, that the horses get really comfortable and confident with it very quickly. That's what I would recommend, because there's quite a few elements in there to the saddling that I can't, you know, explain, you know, kind of in description there. It'd be easier for you to see it that way. And those segments cover both Western and English, because there's a way to place English saddles as well. So also make sure that the saddle has nothing that's causing any discomfort or pain to the horse. You know, sometimes people don't realize, you know, saddles are built, you know, and quality saddles are built well, but even quality saddles, you know, can eventually do, you know, have issues sometimes or fall apart or something like that. So you want to make sure that saddle is checked out. Sometimes people will have a broken tree in the saddle, and it's something that you can't tell, that you could maybe take it to the saddle maker, have them check it, but even take it underneath and push your fingers into the fleece underneath, make sure there's no nails or tacks or anything that are starting to lift out or cause any pain. You want to make sure it's nothing that the horse is trying to tell you, like, well, the pad doesn't hurt me, but that saddle does. You want to make sure it's not a physical thing as well. So you want to address, you know, behavioral patterns through, you know, repetition, on and off, how you swing it on, those kinds of things. But you also want to rule out that it's anything physical as well. You can palpate the horse's back, putting your fingertips, you know, along either side of the spine and either rub down or just press into it and make sure that the horse doesn't have a sore back or sore loins or, you know, lots of different things. So, you know, there's lots of reasons. You know, horses are trying to tell us something in every behavior, whether it's you inadvertently reinforce this behavior to possibly something where that horse is trying to express that they're uncomfortable, you know, something's causing them discomfort, you know, as well. It can be any range of things. That's why I feel like I'm a bit of a detective trying to, you know, recognize clues and pick up on little clues, you know, as to why a horse is doing things. I've seen horses that were really difficult to saddle, you know, coming to clinics, and I have people, you know, just doing the repetitive things, and there was one mare in particular, it was years ago, that the woman spent, you know, the better half of the day just putting the saddle on and off so many times. And I said to her, I said, how do you usually saddle? She says, oh, she's cross-tied. You know, she gets over as far as she can, but limiting the movement of horses. That horse had never been allowed to express itself and exhaust the behavior during saddling. And boy, by the time she was done, she was throwing the saddle. She put the saddle on her ears, you know, and that horse would just be like, I get it. This saddle goes on and off and on and off and on and off. And not while I'm, you know, dancing my feet around. As long as I'm moving my feet around, this saddle's going on and off, on and on and on. You know, and luckily horses, you know, I wouldn't say they're lazy, but they're very energy conserving. Eventually the horse starts going, what am I moving my feet around? The saddle is going on and off a million times. And that's the moment, you know, when you stop. So same kind of principle, different scenario.
Okay. Well, wow, Karen, this hour has just flown by. We're already out of time here, so we appreciate everybody joining us tonight. Is there anything, Karen, you'd like to close with?
Gosh, I'm so delighted with the questions, you know, you know, come in every month. I really enjoy them. I really enjoy, you know, helping people with the horses, and we'll be, you know, having some new things. You know, keep an eye on the email and also Facebook. Facebook has weekly quick tips. So I put quick tips out and get wonderful comments back on that. You know, stay connected to people and keep learning and keep having fun with your horse.
Okay. Well, thanks a lot. Thanks for joining us, and we'll talk to you next month.
Okay. Thanks so much, Melinda, and thanks, everybody.
Good night. Bye-bye.